Hi, I'm Darren Grimes, and you're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Ahead of the European Council Summit in the Austrian city of Salzburg on the 20th of September, we ask, what's next for Brexit? Can the government stick to its beleaguered Chequers proposal? Could the UK take the Norway option whilst negotiating a more comprehensive free trade agreement? To discuss these issues, I'm joined by Stephen Booth of the Open Europe think tank. Stephen argues that Chequers is the only game in town because it's the only deal that meets the EU's tests, and because the government simply does not have the numbers or political capital necessary to move further away from the EU through a Canada-style free trade agreement. Stephen sees the Chequers proposal as a stepping stone to moving further away from the EU regulatory system in the medium to long term. Also joining me is Victoria Hewson, senior counsel at the IEA's trade unit. Victoria argues that the EU's demand for backstop could lock the UK into the EU's orbit in perpetuity. For Victoria, the prospect of our future trading arrangements being determined by parliamentary politics is why Brexiteers are so worried about Chequers. There's a feeling that if we don't seize the momentum we have now, the pro-Remain majority within Parliament will win the day and the opportunities of an independent trade policy and regulatory autonomy will be lost. The pair give their analysis on what's next, how we actually got here, and how all roads lead to Ireland. So, Victoria and Stephen, thank you very much for joining me today and speaking to the IEA. Three major speeches have marked the development of the Prime Minister's Brexit thinking so far, and that has led us to the Chequers proposal. It's already been rejected by EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier, who has rejected key elements of it, and European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker shot down the proposal altogether, almost saying it could, the UK could not choose the parts of the EU it wanted to remain part of and discard the rest. I guess the first question, Stephen, I'll start with you. Does this bode well for Chequers ahead of the EU leaders meeting in the Austrian city of Salzburg on September 20th?
Well, I think the issue here is sort of what needs to be done before March 2019 in order to keep the show on the road, sort of the UK and EU negotiators' point of view. And the future partnership doesn't have to be settled. I think that's part of the issue. The Chequers is really about kind of giving both sides the political cover, if you like, to negotiate the withdrawal agreement and get us into that transition that both sides say they want, under which, I mean, it could have happened a different way, but I think we're going to end up in a situation in which a lot still has left to be sorted out about the future relationship. And now the question is whether Parliament finds that an acceptable situation, whether they want more detail and whether they're effectively prepared to go along with that kind of fudge. But I can see a situation in which we end up in a similar situation as we did in December 2017, where both sides signed a declaration which meant different things to different people. And I think that may be what is required to get us through to the transitional period from April 2019.
So essentially fudging it even further.
Well, I think the one thing, important thing from a Brexiteer's point of view that wouldn't be fudged is we would have left the European Union. Mm. And I think actually that will start to change the political dynamics quite fundamentally at some point, because I think at that point it's very difficult to see the way back through a second referendum, re-entry, that kind of stuff. And while the transition is effectively EU membership in all but name, for sort of a commercial and economic point of view, we'd have left. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a point of no return, I think, that will change the dynamic of negotiations. And I think what everyone kind of needs to remember to some degree is I think that ultimately, if we do end up in that scenario, all of this can be revisited. I mean, even the withdrawal agreement can be revisited. There is a scenario in which it all collapses again. So sort of the idea of a kind of no deal Brexit or trading on WTO terms and so on is a prospect that will run throughout the whole transitional period if fundamental red lines and positions of the UK and the EU remain incompatible. And that usually centres around the issue of avoiding a border in Northern Ireland and the UK wanting an independent trade policy.
And Victoria, why do you think there's been this rejection of the proposal at this point when actually, you know, this isn't about the future relationship, this is about getting us to that finishing line almost, for the start of the finishing line anyway.
From the Brexiteer side, I think the problem they have, and I think this is how Boris Johnson described it, is it's not that our negotiating strategy didn't work, and this is what we've had to accept, is that we never even really tried to push a model based on a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement. We never tabled text to that effect. There was a few speeches in various glamorous and exotic locations. Although they didn't manage to have the one in Newcastle, which was disappointing. Really, the idea of having a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement was basically, it feels like it was strangled at birth by, on the face of it, fears of disruption to trade and to the peace process in Northern Ireland. Now, some people would suggest that actually that was a bit of a fig leaf by which to say, well, we don't really want to leave. This negotiation's actually quite tough. How do we get out of this without looking like we're betraying Brexit? And actually, if you can say you're doing it to preserve the peace process and to support border communities in Northern Ireland and in Ireland, then that gives it a veneer of respectability. So I think that's sort of where the two sides are approaching it from.
Because you hear from Brexiteers that the argument is they're trying to use the Irish border to bounce us into the single market and customs union by proxy. But then on the Remain side of the argument, you hear, well, actually, the Irish border means we can't have a comprehensive free trade agreement with the EU. It has to be something deeper than that. So do you both agree that that's why we've ended up where we are now? Or do you think it is actually just because we haven't attempted to negotiate a free trade agreement?
I mean, I think you're right, and that is why we've ended up where we are. Whether that's because genuinely the government explored every possible option to run an open Irish border from outside the customs union and single market using legal processes and technology solutions and thought actually it can't be done, or whether they thought this will give us a way out of negotiating a free trade agreement and we'll be able to push a Brexit in name only through and blame the Irish border. I wouldn't like to propagate any conspiracy theories. The only point where I would slightly demur from what Stephen said in his opening remarks is that the Irish backstop, as tabled in the withdrawal agreement, wouldn't be a fudge. It would be legally binding, and it would apply in perpetuity whatever ultimate agreement was reached. So if the Chequers plan was worked into an agreement, the Irish backstop would continue in force. And if the EU considered that we had departed from the common rule book or departed from the standards or anything else, they could invoke the Irish backstop and essentially annex Northern Ireland into the customs union and single market, which is why, unfortunately, it's a bit tougher than just saying it's a fudge to get us over the line. I think if it was a fudge to get us over the line, I'd be okay with that, quite frankly, from where we are now. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I think the Irish backstop is intended to be permanent and legally binding.
Mm. Would you agree with that, Stephen?
Well, that's clearly the intention. Mm. But I do wonder whether, I mean, again, it all depends on numbers, right? If the government in the transition period has the numbers in Parliament to say, we entered into the withdrawal agreement in good faith that we were going to have a deal that obviated the need for a backstop, that's not on the table, sorry, this is all up for renegotiation. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could say that might damage the UK's international reputation, but that's an option. Mm-hmm. So the idea, nothing is in perpetuity, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of the politics. And I think so, and part of the reason why we're at Chequers is the politics. There isn't necessarily a majority for the Canada-type deal either, or the Norway one, or so it is a fudge politically as well. But, and I mean, there's also a commercial argument for the Chequers deal, which is that it's, I mean, we looked at the Canada thing, and I think it's the right kind of, I think if it's not Chequers, that's the right kind of direction to try and go in. But I think you have to acknowledge that if the EU isn't willing to recognise that it's gives you the same level of access as you would have had under Chequers, which is what they've been saying, it's a negotiation. You can't force the other side to deal. So Chequers is also meeting some of the EU's tests on what kind of seamless access for supply chains and goods manufacturers would mean. And I think the Canada-type deal would be ideal if the EU would go for it, but it's not clear to us that the EU would be willing to go for it. And perhaps, again, later on in the negotiating process, we might be able to get closer to that. But at the moment, I think, again, it's really about moving negotiations on from both sides' point of view. And I don't know, I think I still think there is actually a lot that still will change, but can change in a transitional period. Mm. But ultimately, it depends on the government of the day having the numbers and the political capital to stand up an alternative approach.
If you both agree that in the long run, Chequers itself is probably unsustainable and we will eventually end up having to make our way out of it, is it not easier to go ahead and go with that, with those alternative proposals, and then pull those levers and mitigate the effect of moving further away perhaps from the EU, and do that now, and let's start talking about those alternatives rather than talking about a proposal that seems to be dead from the off, really?
Well, possibly, but I don't think it's dead from the off, because I think there's enough people have to keep it alive for this Brexit process to work. So it's not dead, I don't think. There are bits of it that may change and everything else, and I think there are bits of it which I think are unsustainable over the longer term, i.e. customs union.
Stephen, are you then sort of accepting the proposition that the bit that's potentially deadest of all is the facilitated customs arrangement? Because I notice you're already actually calling it a customs union. Do you think that in order to achieve the main aim, which is free circulation of goods, this innovative idea of acting as agent for collection of tariffs and then having quite cumbersome systems for either proving that it hasn't gone to the EU or reclaiming the tariff later, do you think that that really is a non-starter, and what we might as well start adjusting to is that it's going to be a customs union?
I wouldn't say that. I think it's going to be a customs union, whatever happens in the interim. The question is whether the FCA is where we end up.
During the transition period or at the end of the transition period?
Well, I mean, can the FCA be up and running by January 2021 is the question. I'm not sure that, I don't know. I think that's uncertain. So I think I'd be sceptical that we would end up directly ending up in the FCA. I think you could see a period in which the standstill transition becomes a phased implementation of something else, in which customs may take longer than other things, for example. Mm-hmm. But I repeat what I said earlier, is I think whatever happens on that, I think either has to be something along the lines of the FCA, which does actually enable the UK a degree of autonomy on tariffs, or I think if it is a customs union by default, I don't think that's politically sustainable with us being outside of the EU over the medium to long term. I just don't think the UK is not like a Turkey. We're not going to sit there and say, look, we don't matter in the world trade negotiations, you guys do it for us. I don't think the British Prime Ministers will be able to do that, particularly a Conservative one. So I just think, again, I'm sort of a bit, I don't know, I think, ideally this would all be sorted now and we wouldn't have a customs union, but I think that, again, there are certain logics to this that will play out in the end. Ideally, it wouldn't take many years to do that, but I think it may do.
Does everything that you've said not sort of back up the Nick Bowles argument, staying in the EEA with a sunset clause?
I think on the EEA discussion is really just, it refuses to go away. It's not an off-the-shelf solution. You can't just slot in as you are, because moving from being an EU EEA party, which is what we are now, to being an EFTA EEA party, in itself requires a lot of negotiation of specific schedules. In a sense, if you have to do that, why not just negotiate your own agreement properly rather than trying to force yourself into an agreement that's not really meant for this scenario? And in any event, would the other parties to the agreement want to go through all of that on a sunset basis, where we'll suck up all this negotiating energy and resource for something that we're going to say thanks and goodbye in like 3 or 5 years?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's what is the exit strategy from the EEA? I think that's not clear to me. And I think exiting using Chequers as a point to distance yourself further from the EU strikes me as easier than using the EEA to do that.
So do you think Chequers is as far as we can go, basically?
I don't know. I don't think, I mean, clearly you could argue for a Canada-style agreement, but the problem with that is coming back to again, Northern Ireland, if that's not an offer to the UK at the moment without the backstop effectively coming into force. That's the EU's negotiating position. Now, you could argue if we'd argued for it more, we might have changed the negotiating position, but that's sort of conjecture at this stage. In terms of what the EU is sort of saying it might be prepared to give us and where we are in terms of sort of where Parliament is, I think Chequers is I mean, it is, it's not it hasn't happened by accident. It's kind of, there is a degree of triangulation there, and that's why we have it. I still think there's a lot to play for in the transition period, and I think we're going to have a lot of these. I mean, we are going to have these arguments again about, does Chequers end up looking more like the EEA, or is there scope to make it more like a Canada deal? There are bits of it that the UK might have to compromise on in terms of going closer to the EU. There are bits of it in which the EU is not going to give us. So we've asked for things on services where the EU is going to say no. We've asked for the exact same aviation arrangements. I'd be very surprised if the EU offered them in that. So there are bits of it where we're going to come off worse in a sort of trade point of view in terms of integration. There are bits where we might end up a bit closer, perhaps on immigration. But the UK government effectively by saying is, we're not going to have free movement, we're going to have an immigration policy that reflects the nature of our trade relationship, is basically saying that this is a negotiating point. Mm. So there's obviously bits of it which will move. Mm. But I think ultimately the choice facing Parliament in whatever it is, January next year, is going to be probably between no deal and an orderly transitional period with still a lot left unanswered. I take Victoria's point about the backstop. I do think that's very difficult. It's very difficult to fudge, which is part of the reason why I think the EU has overplayed its hand in thinking that the backstop is actually a viable long-term option. I don't see the backstop being sustainable in a situation in which the government really has the votes and has the political will to move out of a customs union. I mean, how does the EU and Ireland enforce the backstop against us in that if we really mean it? I think that's I think the EU has sort of overplayed its hand there in terms of the value of what the backstop is actually worth over the sort of a medium term perspective.
Do you see that becoming that, where the Chequers agreement actually just moves into a sort of EEA style agreement?
Well, I think Stephen's completely right that this comes down to politics and where the parliamentary arithmetic sits at any relevant time as this process unfolds. And I think that's actually why Brexiteers are so worried about Chequers and the Irish backstop, because I think there's a feeling that if we don't seize the momentum that we have at present, the unfrozen moment will freeze up again, and the same MPs, you know, the parliamentary sort of consensus that's always been pro-EU and yet was demonstrated not to be in line with the actual thinking of the voters, and the establishment consensus, the vested interests represented by the CBI and others, will cohere around this new arrangement. And instead of it becoming a gradual separation, it will be locked in and will probably more likely be a gradual narrowing and reintegration as those establishment forces sort of regroup and assert their likely parliamentary sort of majority, or at least it's not going to probably be a dominating majority in favour of moving gradually away. It's more likely that it's either going to be a continuing battle like we're having at the moment, or even a majority in favour of rapprochement rather than détente, if I'm using the right terms.
Well, I think there's some truth in that. I think there's going to be different phases to this. I think sort of the Brexiteers have a slight luxury at the moment, is that some of the Remain argument is so focused on a second referendum that they're not even really concentrating on what the deal looks like. I think that moment is going to pass in April. I don't see how we get to a second referendum. I think at that point it's basically dead as an idea. But then there's going to be a new battle about, well, what does the future partnership look like? And that's going to be, again, a case of where does Chequers end up on the spectrum? But I do think over time that the logic of Brexit will mean a more distant relationship, because if you look at the other examples there are, I mean, Norway and Switzerland being kind of the more obvious ones, I mean, they're not identical relationships with the EU. The Swiss have a more distant relationship with Norway because they're less reliant on the EU than Norway is in terms of their economic model, and that's not just a function of the deal they have, it's just that's just the way their economic systems work and everything else. And the UK is even less reliant on the EU than Switzerland. And I think, again, when people get over the sort of emotional shock and living in a world in which we are no longer members of the European Union and actually, look, there are other things we can do, I just think the logic of that will, over time, point in a direction which actually does sort of start to recalibrate our kind of where our kind of heart lies and everything else, and where our head goat will hopefully follow in terms of following the numbers, basically, which is that we have always been a global economy. And the world has fundamentally changed from when we joined in the 70s, i.e. there is much more of a rest of the world to actually engage with than there was in the 1970s. We're in a much stronger position than we were in the 1970s. France and Germany were the future then. They're not the future now. I mean, there's a whole range of reasons why the world is going to be looking different. And I think over that kind of time horizon, 5, 10, 15 years, people's attitudes will change. I think part of the thing that Victoria's talking about is real, that there is a kind of is an amazing lack of imagination from people, sort of the elite, for better want of a better word, that can't seem to think of a way in which we can't be members of the European Union, which is sort of astounding for a country our size. And you think that there are much smaller countries in the world who manage to do it, yeah. So why can't we?
So move our thinking from being so Eurocentric, which it is, it seems to be so focused on one continent, and actually look at... Because, I mean, as an example, you know, I can't remember life outside of the EU. That's all that I've ever known. That's all my generation's ever known.
And mine.
I can understand why there's this fear.
If you know, if to the extent that millennials ever do contemplate these sort of minutiae, apart from yourself, Darren, you know, things like a customs union and the idea of import duties on things that you want to buy feels so old-fashioned in so many ways and so far away from the kinds of things that we now expect of goods being immediately available from wherever we want them, you know, everything being connected. The idea of being sort of geographically compelled by reason of fiscal choices of bureaucrats in Brussels as to what we should be encouraged to buy and from where feels really old-fashioned. And it is odd. Yeah, as Stephen says, there's a certain lack of imagination amongst people thinking, you know, customs union really, is that the best way for a vibrant, global, services-focused economy to actually be set up vis-a-vis its world trade? And especially an economy that is, you know, very import-focused. We import a lot of goods. It's all very well to say, well, you know, our goods trade is European-focused, but actually we're a huge importer of goods, and at the moment that's completely distorted in favour of buying goods from the EU or from countries who the EU wants us to buy goods from. Otherwise, the price differentials are distorted by the policies of the customs union. So in terms of, you know, Britain as an importer of goods, I think actually the facilitated customs arrangement and common rule book is actually quite damaging as well. So we need to think about it from that angle as well, and not be too Trumpian about focusing on exports all the time.
So what do you think? I mean, I hate to be in the game of predictions, especially given the last few years in politics has been, I think we'd all agree, quite mad. But what do you think does happen next? I mean, you sound quite optimistic. There will be a deal.
Well, I just think if you look at the balance of probabilities, I just think that it's likely that we end up with a withdrawal agreement that and Parliament will be faced with a choice between no deal and that. I think Parliament will vote for that. I think the number of Brexiteers in the Tory party will be less than there are now. There will be some who vote against it. I also think that the logic of it not being a future agreement right now will work both ways. So I think the Labour Party, there are going to be people there who will find it quite hard to vote for what would effectively be no deal when actually they're not being asked to vote for what the final solution will be. So it will be do you want an orderly withdrawal and a transition? So I think there will be the votes in Parliament to carry that, I think. I'm not optimistic that all the contradictions of the UK position and the EU positions on, say, Ireland and the customs union and so on will be resolved. So I think the prospect of kind of the talks still breaking down at the end of the transition doesn't go away. I think it's very difficult to see how you get past the Irish backstop in a way that is sustainable over the long term, no matter what is agreed at the end of the transition. I think at some point a future government is going to have to revisit that if Brexit is really going to mean Brexit in the longer term. But I think that's probably a long way from now. And again, who knows? But I think it's quite likely that Parliament votes for the withdrawal agreement, and then there's still a lot to play for in the transitional period.
Victoria, do you think that withdrawal agreement will be passed, will it go through, or do you think it's more likely we'll end up with a no-deal scenario?
No, I think a withdrawal agreement will, one way or another, be dragged over the line. I can't see MPs voting it down. That would be quite incendiary. And actually, it's very strongly in the EU's interests to agree a withdrawal agreement, and I think the European Parliament will also get it over the line. And then, yeah, we're into the transition period, and I must say, again, a familiar refrain from me, preparing for no deal really should have been a huge priority from day one of, from the moment that the referendum was called, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And that really remains so important because, as I keep on saying as well, a lot of the things you would do to prepare for no deal are the same things that will be necessary if you do end up with a free trade agreement. So investing in customs systems, training, and resources, they're not going to be a waste of time, whatever happens, especially if we are, whatever else happens, we have a new Department of International Trade going around trying to improve our rest of world trade. So improving customs systems and improving the expertise of the intermediary sector and improving the resources in HMRC, that's planning both for deal and for no deal. And really, there's no excuse for not doing that kind of thing now.
I think that, first of all, no deal preparation has to carry on throughout the transition, because I do think that I think people have to kind of be hard-headed and sort of, I think the Brexiteers should sort of give up the fight on the backstop. I think we have to be prepared to still be able to walk away at the end of the transition if we're not happy with what's on offer. And I think that on the point about kind of liberal policies and so on, I think ultimately the general direction of the UK on lots of number of issues is going to be more important than the exact details of the Brexit deal. So things on tax, regulation and immigration, whether we're open or not on that. And I think it was always a tough ask to say deliver the kind of liberal Brexit that you might, that sort of the IEA film might wanted in one fell swoop. I think that was, given the nature of the vote, I think it was always unlikely. And ultimately, you're going to need a coalition of some of the people that voted Leave and some of the people that voted Remain to deliver that. And because for sure, not 100% of people who voted Leave voted for a liberal Brexit.
Well, we live in interesting times. Thank you both very much for joining me today. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.